from the festive studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another gift-giving hour, chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. Having trouble finding that special gift for a gardening friend or family member, or maybe yourself? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll present an all-new rundown of the best gifts you can give, plus a year of garden-inspired living, and your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and seasonally scintillating salutations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up right after the news.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John on the blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Second antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY for 30 years.
From the sensibly warm studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another progressive hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we present a highly condensed story. Please read the original article by Rivka Galchin that appeared in the November 17th edition of The New Yorker, which we are calling Drill Baby Drill. Quote, using electricity for heating is not nearly as efficient as using heat for heating. And geothermal wells for heating, which can be relatively shallow, can work in places with no hot springs or volcanoes. In Iceland, a landscape of hot springs, lava domes, and bubbling mud pots, more than a quarter of the country's electricity comes from geothermal sources, a higher proportion than in almost any other nation, and besides, most of the rest is from hydropower. It's all because the underground is heated by hot springs, geysers, and volcanoes, all signs of the inner Earth's inferno. Dante's description of hell is said to have been inspired by the sulfurous steam plumes in Devil's Valley in Tuscany. There is also geothermal energy in Kenya, where it provides almost 50% of the country's energy. New Zealand, about 20%, and the Philippines, about 15%. All volcanic areas along tectonic rifts. But the costs and uncertainties of drilling in search of sufficient heat in other areas have curtailed development. In 2005, the Department of Energy under George W. Bush commissioned a group of 18 experts and researchers to investigate what it would take to produce 100,000 megawatts of geothermal energy, a bit more than one-fifth of the energy the U.S. had consumed that year. The experts avoided framing their support for geothermal in environmental terms, quote, because then it would be perceived as being about climate change. Barry Smitherman, an oil and gas regulator in Texas, explains, what we've always said about energy is that you need three legs, reliable, clean, and cheap. The old saying was, I can give you two out of three, but I can't give you all three. Geothermal has begun to look like it has all three, low to no carbon, 24/7, and a cost curve that eventually comes down to cheap. It really looks like a unicorn resource. Midtown Manhattan, as part of a major renovation completed in 2017, 10 geothermal wells were dug beneath St. Patrick's Cathedral. Some of the wells are less than 100 meters, while others extend more than 650 meters, more than 10 times deeper than Manhattan's deepest subway tunnel, and yet much shallower than the wells needed for a full-scale geothermal power plant. These wells carry warmth into the cathedral in winter and out of the cathedral in summer, and they do so with less noise and vibration than typical HVAC systems. When the cathedral system was built, it felt radical. But now there's also the MasterCard headquarters in Purchase, New York, and the Obama Presidential Center in Chicago. In Brooklyn, an 834-unit apartment complex that's under construction has its heating and cooling provided by 300 boreholes. Geothermal systems for heating and cooling individual homes remain somewhat pricey to install, but they last for decades, reduce energy bills by 25 to 50%, and avoid reliance on the ever more burdened electrical grid. Quote, I'm sure the next person will find it even easier. They'll say, look, Kalahari has made this a success. Therefore, we're going to make it a success, and we'll do it even faster.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in the Christmas city of Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, I will deliver a list of suggested gifts that any gardener would be happy to receive. And now it's time for one of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Linda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there. How are you?
I am just ducky, Linda. How are you doing?
I am well. You have to be on a gorgeous day like today.
And where is it gorgeous where you are today?
We are situated between Wrightsville in New York and countryside Pennsylvania under about 5 acres of 100-foot oak trees.
Oh, okay.
York, Pennsylvania.
York, Pennsylvania. Do they still have the giant barbells over top of that manufacturing plant?
They are still there, but I think that plant was sold, wasn't it?
Yeah. But move a gym in there and it's perfect, right? Now, I'm told that you have either advice for us or you want to tell us how you do a popular technique. Am I correct?
Well, yes, I have a different way of caging tomatoes.
Everybody wants to hear this. So what do you do to keep your tomatoes off the ground?
Well, first let me tell you, I grow in 4x6x10 inch high raised beds.
Okay, very good.
So I have pathways around them. I garden at a community garden.
Okay.
But my problem with a conventional round cage made out of just fencing is I always was cutting my arms on the holes that you cut to reach the tomatoes.
Ah, I know you were doing it right then, yeah.
Or, because I put 12 plants in every box, I could never get to the middle tomatoes.
Right, okay. I want to mention two things here. There is apparently a new company out there. I've been reading about them, and I wish I could remember their exact name, but they make garden sleeves that run from your hand all the way up to your shoulder kind of like the sleeve tattoos that some people get. And they designed them for rose growers, but that's exactly what they're meant to do, to protect your arms when you're growing prickly stuff like raspberries and roses, again, especially. I think they would be a nice, inexpensive addition for people who are using my 6-foot tomato cage design to be able to get in there and harvest the tomatoes. I'll also suggest that it sounds to me, and I realize your space may be limited, there's a couple more tomatoes in there than there's room for.
Well, you know, it's survival of the fittest. Because we water with a spring well, so it's hand watering.
Excellent.
The Mother Nature has to do her thing the majority of the time for us.
Right.
What I basically do is, my husband helps me with this, is you put 6 fence posts in your box, 4 on each corner and 2 about 3 feet from each end. And then instead of taking your 6-foot fence and doing it vertically, you do it horizontally. So you're basically making a scaffold for the tomatoes to grow through. They have 4 or 5 layers of fencing attached to the posts by PVC.
This is an old and almost lost technique, but it used to be popular back in the days when I was the editor of Organic Gardening. Oh, it's called stake and weave.
Hmm.
And what you do is, as you said, you set up your stakes, you plant your tomatoes, and as they grow, you wrap string through your area so that as every tomato reaches the next level, it's laying down on top of the string, waiting for you to string another level, and then ad infinitum. And like my cage, you might be growing a 12-foot-long tomato, but once it gets to the top, it'll start coming back down again. And all the tomatoes are off the ground and in the air just where you want them. You know, I have seen this technique many times in Philadelphia's Chinatown, the community gardens. Most of the plants that need support are in a stake and weave situation. So, it's almost a lost art. I'm glad to hear you talk about it.
But the difference is you're using fencing, so you don't have to do all that weaving and winding of cording.
So what are you doing instead?
So you cut your fence the same size as your box, and because those poles have holes in them going
right
up, you can just take a zip tie and attach the fence to your 6 poles horizontally.
But then if you're growing a big heirloom, doesn't it get dicey when they reach the top of the stake?
Usually what they do is they just sort of lay on top of that top layer.
Well,
they go sideways.
I will suggest, you already have a system that's working. I would suggest the weaving as an improvement. I mean, maybe you do it 3 or 4 times during the summer. But it's amazingly effective at utilizing space and keeping the tomatoes off the ground.
Well, but you don't need to do that because the tomato grows through the fence vertically and spreads out on each layer of the fence as it grows.
Okay. It's a little hard to imagine. What supports the plants in the middle?
Just itself.
Oh, okay. So
your bottom layer of fencing is probably 12 inches from the ground.
Okay. And
so it grows stronger through each layer of fence.
Okay.
And if it's out the side, you just tuck it back in and add a little string or something.
All right. Well, you need to send us a photo of this.
I think I did.
You think you did? Send it again, because I'm a bubblehead. And
hey,
we'll put it up on our Facebook page when this show airs so that people can see what we're talking about.
I do that.
Okay.
That sounds good.
But there are many ways to grow tomatoes, and we want to hear about every single one of them.
Now, I do have one other tip for you. When you do this, it sort of looks like a construction scaffold.
Right.
When you're done. Well, if you have frost, or like we at the community garden, because we're organic, have bugs all over the place.
I do not endorse that sentiment. If there are bugs in an organic community garden, somebody there is doing something terribly wrong, because you don't have a lot of insect pressure when agricultural chemicals aren't involved. It's the false growth that the chemicals cause that attracts insect pests like mad.
Interesting.
But
I have, they've only been doing the gardens about 20 years at the Horn Farm.
Right.
And are surrounded by farm fields, which have converted to organic practices, but they're still in the process of.
Well, that is, you know, community gardens are great if you don't have enough room at home, but you do wind up having to coexist with other gardeners. And I will tell you, this has proven true over the years, the only thing that two gardeners can agree on is that the third gardener is wrong.
Oh, my. Yeah, well, you know, we garden there because we are on 3 acres of land with no tree cutting except for where your house is.
Good.
Or if they're endangering, you know, falling on your house. So I have probably 60 bags of shredded leaves by the end of fall.
Ha, ha, ha. Good girl.
Thanks to my husband. He's the one that does it. And yeah, then I take those to the community garden. That's what I put in our pathways, and eventually the worms eat them down, and then they get put into the boxes.
I have done that for many years. I have mulched the pathways between my raised beds, and then when I could see that everything was degraded and I was seeing worm poop in there, I would use that soil to add to my beds.
Yes. Well, if I put cardboard under those leaves, the cardboard's gone by the end of summer.
It really is, but it has protected you from weeds that summer.
Oh, but not thistle. And not wild morning glory. I've been fighting that for 10 years.
Okay, wild morning glory is actually called bindweed, and it is a really treacherous vining pest, but it can be controlled. You know, if you want to call back, we'll talk about bindweed, but now we got to go.
Okay, it's been fun talking to you, Mike.
Same thing, very much here, okay?
All righty. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of yous what have a cut Christmas tree in the house that it needs pre-hydration to prevent needle drop. But don't go marking next week's show, where we will reveal the details on your calendar just yet, because we'll be right back with a year of garden-inspired living and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in the Christmas city of Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show is a brand new list of garden goodies that you can gift to your gardening friends or relatives, each one guaranteed by me personally to delight. But don't complain. But before that, we have an interview. Linda Vader, who was with us last year for a different book, author of The Elegant and Edible Garden, is here to discuss her newest book, A Year of Garden-Inspired Living. Linda lived and gardened for over 30 years in her 1935 English Tudor home before moving to her very lively, quote, cottage on the hill in Oklahoma City. Shout out to Oklahoma City. We love you guys. Her gardens have been featured in numerous national and local magazines and have been toured more times than she can count. Linda, with me, that's only like the 19. Come on. Linda Vader, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, I'm glad to be back. This was very fun last year, and I am anticipating the same this year.
Well, let's hope you're right. So, let us start out by saying this is not all about gardening. It is written by a gardener, but it also has, what would you call them? Household tips to make you happy, you know?
Well, I think it's just... it's embracing the seasonality of gardens and how gardens can inspire every aspect of our lives. And I think when you become an older gardener, like moi, you realize that gardening really transcends just cucumber beetles and dahlia tubers. And it just means a lot more than that. What I have found is gardening, and it's related luxuries and sensuality can kind of help slow down time. And as you get older, I think that's important.
Oh, you're preaching to the choir, baby. Bending is for chumps.
Well, but if you don't do it, you'll lose it. So there's got to be some bending, but I think there's also got to be some just quiet appreciation of what's around you.
Oh, good Lord, I had not marked up your book. Maybe out of some respect for it, and I'm here thinking, oh, geez, I left my cheat sheet at home. But I just found it. So
good.
We're good to go. And by the way, anyone who listens to the show regularly, none of this is a surprise. Now, you got the book in front of you?
I got the book in front of me.
Turn to page 34. Oh, wow.
Okay.
I just had a high school flashback.
Okay. I've got kindergarten, garden, and bottomless performance. So which one are we going for?
Kindergarten. Now, people always ask me about school gardens. And outside of San Diego, Southern Texas, and Southern Florida, and some other areas where cowards go to live, the school year is the opposite of the gardening year. And mm-hmm. I have struggled to come up with stuff for kids to do during the school year that they can replicate in the world or that'll mm-hmm. just work. The one that I came up with, and this involves outdoor planting, is on the first day of school, every kid gets a daffodil bulb. And they get to go outside and plant it and write their name on a popsicle stick next to it. And as you and I know, That daffodil is going to come up. They're bulletproof. They're from Krypton. And it will come up before the school year ends.
Right.
So what are you saying here?
Well, I'm saying that I think sometimes as gardeners, we concentrate so much on the productivity at the end and ultimately whether something is a success or a failure in terms of our harvest or the quality of the bloom or duration of the bloom or those kinds of things. But the entire process of gardening is educational in and of itself, because things like learning the skill of just seed identification. First of all, just seeing a seed germinate to me gives me as much thrill as it does, you know, now that I'm old, as it did when I was in kindergarten. And right there, in there lies success. And teaching kids, you know, what different seeds require to get them to germinate. And then identifying the seedling, which is very specific to the type of plant it is, becomes a skill.
I'm going to stop you there. Mm-hmm. Because when you get to things like stratification and cold treatment, we're now out of kindergarten. We're at a higher grade.
But in general, the principle that you convey is seeds like people take different kinds of conditions to thrive.
Well, I would even suggest that seeds like people are very different, but they're all alike in that they're the beginning of a plant. So show a kid tomato seed, pepper seed, then show them pea seed and bean seed.
Yeah, sunflower seeds.
Yeah, exactly. Lay out all the different sizes and explain that these are all plants to be, but they all start out as seeds. And then as a ringer, put an acorn out.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, and so, again, you're just taking something and doing a deep dive into it, but things that kids would, I think, really become infatuated with. And then when they see that little, you know, round, you know, speck transform and germinate into something, and each one of those somethings is different from the other something that they've planted, you know, it's just fun. And before you know it, I've got lots of kids on my street, and we get down on our hands and knees, and we look, and we, you know, compare one seedling to the next one, and what will this turn into? And even adult gardeners who come, we talk a lot about the importance of seedling identification.
When I was the editor of Organic Gardening, we ran a photo article showing food sprouts and weed sprouts.
Yeah.
And that was
yeah.
probably one of the best things we ever did. Now, before we leave kindergarten, I still have never left. Let's say that in addition to showing them the difference, we send them home with a couple of seeds that they can grow successfully in a little plot at their parents' house, and something that doesn't need support. So I think your sunflower idea is right on.
Yeah.
And every kid could grow a different sunflower. Make them ornamental, not the big ones.
Well, I just think it's the process. You know, what is it? It's not the destination, it's the journey. And I think a lot of times we gardeners, we concentrate too much on the end result and not on the process. And I think by teaching kids, by teaching adults or whatever, that there is as much satisfaction and joy in the process as there is in the end result. And the older I get, the more I realize that. One of the favorite things this year was I had all sorts of, because I'm sure of a rotting jack-o'-lantern, I had all sorts of pumpkins and gourds that were just coming up in and around the garden. And when the kids would come over and we would look at them and talk about them and, oh, where might this have come from? Then they, you know, have started doing the same this year with their old rotten jack-o'-lantern.
Oh, I just had a mean thought.
What's that?
Tell the kids to get this. Well, they scoop the seeds out to make a jack-o'-lantern, and they're big seeds. Tell the kids to dry them and keep them cool, but not cold, and dry, very dry. Dryness is everything. And plant them in the spring in an area that has lots of room. And you can either tell them it probably won't be a pumpkin, or you can say it will be a surprise plant, like the box you buy for $5 that has all the leftovers in it. Because I grew a fabulous Connecticut Field pumpkin patch in my early days, and they were perfect, and I knew nothing. So I saved the seeds, planted them next year, and luckily I planted them pretty close to a line of trees because the kids went into school and told the teacher that white gourds grow on trees.
Well, now, did you carve your initials in any of them when they were small to watch your initials grow large?
The seed? The gourds.
Into the pumpkins. Yeah, the pumpkins are gourds.
Yeah, I never thought of that. So you carve your initial in when it's small, and it will grow with the plant. Darn you.
Carve your initials in a pumpkin, carve your initials, and then assuming the squash bugs don't take out the plant, if the pumpkin continues to grow, then your name or your initials or the happy face or whatever it is you carved into that tiny pumpkin will continue to grow.
Okay. And wait a minute.
Very fun.
Wait a minute. I don't like that idea for pumpkins. Because cutting into the flesh can attract insects or mice that will deflate the pumpkin. You could put a sticker on it, but it wouldn't grow. I like the idea. I think everybody should grow dipper gourds at one point in time. And, you know, they have to be trellised. So white dipper gourds, yes. Maybe the baby pumpkins that would be trellised up high, because you know the fruits are small but the vines are not, that might work. But, you know, you want to avoid injury to pumpkins in the patch. You mean you do this and you get away with it?
Yeah, I did it when I was little. Now, maybe Lady Luck was just shining down on me. Or maybe it's because the cuts weren't deep enough or they were protected or, you know, I'm going back in time, Mike. But you're right. I think when a pumpkin germinates or something, it's just, first of all, it's so dramatic and so spectacular. And if you don't know what it's going to grow into, first of all, you just get those gorgeous yellow flowers. And then
I love those squash blossoms. You know, I want to say right here, you can easily differentiate between male and female squash blossoms because the females have a little ball-like structure that forms at the end. You'll get all males first, but the females will come later. And any squash blossom can be picked when it's absolutely fresh. And then what do? You smear some cream cheese inside or something.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're growing pumpkins for Halloween, don't plant them with your tomatoes. Read the days to maturity on your packet. I used to plant mine in July, and they would be ready in October.
Well, I think the important thing is to just try. You know, get out there and just try for the experience. And I garden in Oklahoma, so it's kind of a crapshoot here whether or not something is successful. But I think the thing is when you look at it through the lens of, isn't this a fun project and not just what's in it for me at the end, then you can amortize your enjoyment over the life of the experience of the plant itself. And if it succumbs prematurely to something or whatever, well, I enjoyed it while I was there, and then I'll thank it for its service and throw it into the compost pile.
As we get further into the book, into the season, there's more gardening stuff, of course. But I was charmed by page 135.
135.
Din, 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 din.
Oh, what a guy, what an idea. The bottle bouquet, the blue bottle bouquet.
So describe it, and then I'll tell you what I'm going to do.
Well, I went to a friend of mine who, first of all, he's an avid gardener and a lover of blue and white and just maximalist decor. And he had a beautiful vignette on his entryway of all sorts of really large potted plants of different succulents and things like that. And it was just absolutely exquisite. And some of them were that kind of, you know, blue glazed pottery. And it was a Spanish home. So the blue and the Spanish exterior of the house just was a wonderful combination. And then right near his door, he had kind of like a huge galvanized bucket in mm-hmm. it. And then there was just every shade of blue bottle. And, you know, some of them were wine, some of them were gin, all sorts of different things.
I've seen a lot of vodka bottles that are blue.
Yeah, not that you've imbibed any, I'm sure.
Moving on.
No, they're exquisite, and then when it was positioned to just capture the beautiful sunlight, and then it would reflect and refract, and it was just beautiful, and it cost him nothing. They were all just kind of nestled in there, and it was really, really beautiful. It's something I had seen frequently in Santa Fe, mm-hmm. and I was up north in Bunny Williams Garden and some gardens up north recently, and, you know, they have those bottle trees.
Right.
So if you've got the right context for them, it's really, really beautiful, and it's charming, and it's delightful.
And I will tell you, I was inspired. I do not drink a lot of soda, maybe mm-hmm. one bottle a month. But I grew up loving Coca-Cola, and
right.
now hate Coca-Cola because of the high fructose corn syrup. And then I found Mexican Coke in my local supermarket, and that's just sugar. But it's in the same classic trademarked bottle that mm-hmm. since the turn of the century. And they're too nice to throw away, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been collecting them, but they've been collecting dust. So now, after all the holidays are over and everything, I'm going to make a Coke bottle upside down, and the light will shine
yeah.
through it
right.
beautifully. Well,
yeah.
I hate to tell you, because we're having such fun, that our time is up. We have been speaking with Linda Vater about A Year of Garden-Inspired Living. It's available everywhere. And you might also want to check out her previous book, The Elegant and Edible Gardening. So, Linda, thank you very much for being on You Bet Your Garden again. And we'll probably see you next year, right?
Well, I better get busy then. You take care and happy holidays.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and suggest that a membership to the station that produces and distributes this show would make an excellent gift for a devoted listener or yourself. And anyone who makes such a gift before Christmas will receive a lucky duck charm directly from me. But you have to ask for it, and quantities are limited. But don't go looking up membership details at WDIY.org just yet, because we'll be right back with other great gifts for gardeners and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of NPR station WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Are you tired of sharp green needles decorating your floor a week before Christmas? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to pre-hydrate a tree so it will stay fresh past New Year's. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in the Christmas city of Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we are in the stretch, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will deliver a brand new list of suggested gifts that any gardener would be happy to receive. All you got to do is listen to one more phone call, and then we'll get to it. 610-694-8100, Topper. Welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Topper. How you doing?
I am fine.
All right. So what can we do you for?
Well, I live in what basically used to be a woods. But our front yard, when the first people that built this house moved in, they cut all but about 14 really tall, mature trees. And it's a nice shade canopy, but in the summer, what used to be lawn is just covered with Japanese stilt grass. And I'm afraid to cut it because I'm trying to get the front yard to return to just regular forest. And I don't want to cut down the saplings, like there are little oaks and lots of maples that I really don't want. And then tons of wildflowers that show up in the spring, and I don't want to crush them to death with our big zero-turn lawnmower in the summer. So I don't know how to get rid of the Japanese stilt grass.
How much sun does it get?
It's partial shade all the time. The trees are 40 to 50 feet high.
You're not going to be able to grow grass under that kind
of...
Well,
I don't want to grow grass. I just want the trees to thicken up over time. And since I'm 80 years old, I guess it's really sort of stupid to think that I will see the oak trees grow. But I figure if, you know, some acorns have actually grown into little, what do you call them, seedlings?
Yeah.
And they're about 6 inches tall with leaves on them. If I mark those, I can, you know, leave them if I do mow.
Now, the spring ephemerals, they've been coming up nicely?
Yes, yes.
Because I can't see any reason they wouldn't coexist with the stilt grass.
I guess this is the question. I'm okay leaving the stilt grass as long as it's not, you know, killing everything else.
Well, it doesn't appear to be. You know, physical reality has a place in these conversations.
Well, true. Okay, well, that's encouraging.
So listen, Japanese stilt grass is an annual. It's not a perennial. It seems to return in the same spot year after year because it drops a huge number of seeds.
Yes.
So what I'm going to suggest is if you just want to approach this very casually, is to get yourself a flame weeder. Have you heard me talk about these?
I have certainly. I have listened to you for at least 30 years. Would that be correct?
Yeah, pretty close, yeah. So a simple flame weeder, a small one, a yard and garden torch. Then all you would do is go over the tops of the stilt grass late in the summer. You don't even have to dehydrate all of the stilt grass. You just want to pop the seeds. Okay, here, I'll read this for you. Don't mow because Japanese stilt grass will simply grow lower and make seed heads lower than your mower height. It sets flowers and seed late in the season from mid-September through October. Now, the best way to use this information is to allow the grass to grow naturally until September or October when it develops its seed heads. Now, this is from Penn State, and then they recommend weed whacking or hand pulling. I think it makes a lot more sense to just get out there in September and wave that flame weeder over tops of the stilt grass, it will prevent the next generation of seeds. Now, it may continue to come up for a couple of years because the seed bank in the soil, those seeds last for around 6 years. But once you've prevented seeding, in a year or two, it'll be so weak, it'll only come up here and there. The clumps pull easily out of the ground, really saturate that soil, and then pull gently, and you won't disturb the flowers around it.
We had no rain in September this year, and very little. We've just gotten some rain, but anyway, we'll have to balance the flame throwing with getting a little moisture in the soil.
All you have to do is have a helper with a garden hose, and if you see anything else smoking or anything like that, or even just when you're done, spray the whole area with water.
Aside from the stilt grass, in the fall, my husband will get out with the lawnmower that has a mulcher on it and go over everything, including the stilt grass, but their leaves from the trees. Is that okay for
if the seeds? Oh, it's fine for the wildflowers.
Okay.
If the seeds have not been desiccated before he does that, he's spreading them. He's planting those seeds.
Okay.
All right, you have a good season, and I think you got a great plan for keeping it under control.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your help, and my husband and I love your show and have for years.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we're calling Not the Last Minute Gifts for Gardeners. A You Bet Your Garden tradition this time of year is for me to run a piece like this about 5 days before Christmas. By divine intervention, I have been enlightened to revise, edit, add, and subtract things from 5 previous years' worth of suggestions in time for people to actually act on them. Don't get used to it, people. This is like being in the eye of a hurricane. As always, some of the things I'll mention can be purchased in stores. You remember stores? And online. Ready? Here we go, cats and kittens. The new number one selection, up from number two last year, is pruners. There isn't a gardener alive who would not be delighted with a new pair or two of high-quality pruners. Heck, even I need new pruners. Growing up, I was told that I was, quote, hard on clothes, which continues to be true with my garden tools. We're talking high-quality, ergonomic pruners. This is not a dollar store gift. The good ones are more than worth the extra money. And besides, you shouldn't be cheaping out on gifts. Santa is watching. Your friendly neighborhood independent garden center should have them on display as they are now open for Christmas. And that neighborhood garden center is as endangered as a small family farm, and they deserve your support. Speaking of Christmas, please don't decorate your tree until you hear next week's show. If you already bought that tree, saw an inch off the bottom of the trunk, and sit it in a bucket of water for now. My number one gift idea for many years had been baseball batting gloves. Now dropped to number two on the hit parade, just like the great Louis Armstrong did to the Beatles in 1964. We're not talking ordinary garden gloves. Batting gloves fit so tight, you, quote, could pick up a dime, maybe. I personally can't pick up a dime without professional assistance. They come in a wide variety of sizes, youth and adult in small, medium, and large, and extra large in the adult version. Sporting goods stores should have them in stock and maybe even on display. Ask your gift recipient if you can trace their hand for a mysterious project you're starting. A worm tower. No, not a worm bin. I can't comprehend how people manage a bin. How do you know when stuff is done if you're constantly adding new material? A worm tower has a base unit with a spigot and stackable trays. The spigot is to drain off worm juice. You fill each tray with kitchen waste. No meat, no bones, no citrus, and go very light on things like bread, pasta, rice, and onions. Then you simply add shredded newspaper, not junk mail. Find some newspapers on top of your garbage. New trays go on top and the worms below, and the finished and half-finished trays migrate up. My unit is from Gardens Alive, who now call it the Worm Factory. Not sure if they or other online suppliers can ship the actual worms in winter, but you can get starter worms anywhere they sell live bait for fishing. Make sure you get red wigglers, the Cadillac of worms, and not night crawlers. And no, it doesn't smell and they don't get loose, and kids love feeding the worms. No room for a worm tower and or a little too squiggly for you? A device that has been around for a long time called the green cone is a simple plastic cone you sink into your soil. It's open at the bottom. You add whatever kitchen waste you can, including bones and such, into the top. The cone traps heat and turns your garbage into soil you can either use or leave it in the earth when you move the cone to another spot. It has a cap, but I would spray it regularly with deer repellent if raccoons are a problem. And I do not recommend it if you have bears. In Colorado, not that long ago, I was invited to speak at a newly revived theater in Cortez, and I stayed in a private house on a ranch. No outdoor light pollution. So I stood outside for an hour, stargazing at the most magnificent sight I had ever seen. The next morning at breakfast, the couple hosting me said, "Hey, did you see the bear? Tracks are right outside your door." A rechargeable leaf shredder. Advances in battery technology have made rechargeable handheld blower vacs lighter in weight with a longer running time. Look for a unit, actually only get a unit, that has a swap-out funnel for sucking up leaves. These will all come with a shoulder-held collection bag that handles the now shredded leaves. Look also for a good warranty. And if you're lucky, you might find a package that has two rechargeable batteries inside. Note, some units are sold without the battery, so make sure it says includes battery and charger. A great way to collect and shred your leaves without bending over. Santa says bending is for chumps. And finally, for deer, a motion-activated sprinkler for spring, summer, and fall. You'll find many online and at your local garden center. And the wireless deer fence for winter, still sold by the inventor's family at wirelessdeerfence.com. Write it down now. You can also listen to this show again at wdiy.org and on multiple podcast platforms to catch it. They're sold in packs of three. Green stakes with small electrodes at the top and deer attractant pellets you place inside the electrodes. Install a couple of AA batteries in the belly and deer will come to the attractant, get a very mild shock, and run off to eat the neighbor's hostas. This is a small family-owned business. WirelessDeerFence.com. Well, that sure was a lot of gift-giving options now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to poach my pruners if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. And as always, if you happen to live anywhere, please tell us where it is. And visit our Facebook page, where we post new photos of our gardens and invite you to send us photos of your precious plants and share your thoughts about the show. We also provide important and informative updates about the show. A link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when Amazing Fantasy number 15 hit the comic book spinner racks and Spider-Man was born. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprut. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Special thanks to our guest, Linda Vader, author of A Year of Garden-Inspired Living, available now and published by Quattro. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm just settling down for a short winter's nap, long before those noisy reindeer can wake me up and knock down the roof decorations. But I'll wake up in time to see you again next week.